Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to St. James Cathedral. If we have not met before, my name is Robert, and I'm the director of music here. I should tell you that when I was a child, I remember seeing portraits of Pope John Paul II in pretty much every room of my grandparents' house. I saw his face a lot. My grandparents were indeed Polish Roman Catholics, and I grew up attending a Catholic cathedral in Vienna, in Austria, where Catholic composers Haydn and Mozart would work, marry their Catholic wives, and have their Catholic funerals. Well, I'm still going to try to be as objective as possible in my remarks this evening. And throughout our education series on the Reformation, you're going to see some incredible artifacts. You're going to hear about priceless documents and perhaps even some unfamiliar liturgy. You may have heard my brother, Adam, give a lecture last month on the Protestant aesthetic in painting. Tonight, however, we explore the sound of the Reformation. And we're going to trace our musical heritage right back across the centuries, all the way up to what you hear in the pews on a Sunday. Don't worry, this will only take an hour, in theory. You may have seen advertisements calling this year the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, as if the Reformation was a single event or a defined point in history. And it is the anniversary of something, and we'll get to that. But it's also very tempting to talk about culture and religion in linear bullet points. You know, this, then this, then this, then this. Or to read articles such as, "Everything you need to know about North Korea in 200 words. Patterns of change are invariably more complex than this age of memes, tweets, and jingles would have us believe. Music and religion have intermingled for millennia because they both speak in their own way to the innermost fibers of our being through the intangible and the transcendent. There is a useful cliche that says that talking or writing about music is like dancing about architecture. And this may serve to undermine everything I have to say tonight, but it highlights the quality of the subject that resists and avoids a wholly objective analysis. So there's no doubt in my mind that singing to a particular deity or deities would have taken place for epochs prior to the compiling of the Old Testament. Singing is a most natural, universal expression which can be attested to by shower rooms and bathrooms across the globe. We know that Jesus sang. In the Gospel of Matthew at the Last Supper in chapter 26, we hear, "This is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many for the remission of sins." And when they had sung an hymn, they went out into the Mount of Olives. Mary's response to hearing the message of the angel Gabriel is referred to in the Gospel of Luke as the Song of Mary. We sing her words, the Magnificat, every Sunday at 4:30 at Evensong. Simeon's response to witnessing the infant Christ in the temple is referred to as the Song of Simeon. And we sing those words too, the Nunc Dimittis, every Sunday. The Old Testament is overflowing with music. Aside from the Song of Songs, we have the Book of Psalms, which are peppered with musical directions. Some of the Psalms are addressed to the leader or the choir master and specify instruments such as harps, trumpets, lutes, timbrels. These 150 hymns of praise or lament have been realized and sung in many different ways over the centuries. The oldest surviving notated psalms come in a form known as plain chant, dating from around the 9th century. Now, paper was a precious luxury, and much music before this time was simply not notated, but passed down through generations by ear. Plain chant, I suppose, is a misleading name for this form of expression, because it is far from plain. It is complex in notation, conception, and execution. And we happen to have some highly skilled singers here tonight who are going to give us a taste of 9th century psalmody in Psalm 44, sung in Latin, as you might have heard it in a European cloister. And just so you know what we're singing about, Psalm 44, this little extract says, "And the king shall desire thy beauty. Hearken, O daughter, and see, and incline thine ear, and forget thy people and thy father's house." It seems pretty innocuous, doesn't it? And when you have superstars filling their albums with swearing, sexist content, and a hideous sort of thudding, you know, hearing plain chant seems like the least controversial, the least offensive noise in comparison. However, in the time of the Vikings and the Norman invasion of the British Isles, this music was political and very powerful. Imagine the protest songs of the band Pussy Riot outside the Kremlin. Or imagine the Sex Pistols singing God Save the Queen. Now, violence and music also have a close history that predates our textbooks. And I want to read you an 11th century account which describes the reception given to one Norman monk when he was appointed to a vacant English abbey. I quote, it's the 11th century. "The monks of Glastonbury detected the attitude of a conqueror in Thurston of Normandy. Though there the point of contention was the style of chant, the monks wanting to keep their old chants as against those which Thurston wanted to foist upon them. In a fit of uncontrollable anger, Thurston set his knights onto the monks. Three of them were killed and many more injured in their own church where they tried to take refuge." So we know that arguing about music is as old as the hills. And that killing one another, or at least maiming one another, has been justified because of it. But what happened next to plain chant? Well, human beings, as we know, have a perilously short attention span, as I can see. We have a natural desire to embellish and adorn our clothing and our homes and our surroundings. And plain song, too, was embellished and adorned. First, it was done by singing the same pitches, but stacked on top of one another in a style called organum or faubourdon, which sounds like this.
Thank you.
So that's one of the first elaborations here. And the voice parts themselves came to be named after their relationship with plain chant. The root of our familiar word tenor is the Latin word tenere, which means to hold. The tenor voice literally holds the plain chant. And alto simply means high and sounded higher than the plain chant. And the word soprano is derived from the Latin word sopra, which means above. The soprano part sounds above the alto part. And basso means low and forms the part which sits below the plain chant. Now, as the Catholic faith spreads across Europe in the aftermath of Emperor Constantine's adoption of Christianity, composers elaborated with plain chant for hundreds and hundreds of years. By the time of the 1360s, we have our first polyphonic mass by one composer. Before then, liturgical music was something of a hodgepodge conglomerate affair of disparate and local customs by multiple unnamed composers. Now, Guillaume de Machaut wrote his Messe de Notre-Dame for Rheims Cathedral in the north of France for four voices, and it is indeed built around a much slowed-down plain chant, which is sung in the tenor part. I just want to give you a taste of that, the very first polyphonic mass by one composer. Agnus Dei, qui tollis peccata mundi. That sort of thing, but you hear it's much slowed down right in the middle. Oh.